We'll kick things off and get started, and just I want to say to Dr. Tom and to the staff, that was excellent. So really a fitting tribute. You pulled off the surprise. You didn't make him shoot half court shot his name on there, so all was really well done. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to President Labasso.
Great. Well, thank you. And I think it went well. It was a well-deserved recognition for someone who was, like I said, he was even a student here. That's how many years he's had affiliated with the college. So certainly a tribute. Yeah, he will be. I know he'll be in the stands now as a fan, supporting the students along the way. So great to see that. So thank you all for agreeing to approve that name tonight. All righty, so we will go through our agenda here, and I'll just, like previous years, just a brief recap on highlights of the year, and then some current activity, and then some things we're thinking about, for the future. And then there's a board open discussion, but just feel free to, we can talk on any topic you want as we go through. But, okay, I figured I'd kick it off with another championship here of some sorts. But, best online baccalaureate degrees, 14 years in a row. We are the number one of the college system to be there, and 24th in the entire country. So it's certainly, something we work hard at maintaining. It's, sometimes it's hard to maintain the ranking than it is to get there. So we're happy to continue that streak. Just an update on our resource development, just to give you an update. That, currently managing 29 active grants, over $17 million. So they do bring in quite a bit of revenue to college, and we have five pending proposals, a potential of another $3.6 million in a variety of grants. You all see those grants in the board packet from time to time to approve. And then again, just looking at this past year, some of the things we were able to accomplish that we set out the year before to do was we were able to bring paramedics, EMS, to the Flagler Palm Coast campus. It's been extremely successful. So we're, it's as we've been doing over the years, trying to bring where it makes sense to bring replicate programs on other regional campuses. So that's, adds more enrollment to that campus, serves the community there. And we worked with the technical college there, as well as the firefighters there that asked us to bring some programs like this up there. So our aerospace technology AS degree kicked off this spring. So we have that program starting. We have, this past November, I went to the state board and had the aviation maintenance management degree approved. So that's in process. We look to start that one. We're working diligently with the FAA. We keep getting some snags. We're trying to, Embry-Riddle is, and we got into an agreement, Embry-Riddle is going to let us use their building, and we can start classes this fall at night. We had an open house at Embry-Riddle a week or so ago, and had 102 students show up.
Wow.
It was with parents and stuff, it was like 300 people that were at.
What's the capacity in any given semester?
When we have our own building, we will be over 400 students.
Their building?
In their building, it's just a night program, so I think just a cohort of 25 to start.
Okay.
Yep. So what was exciting is that the interest was there, and we haven't even started it yet. And high-paying jobs. We're getting approvals with FAA is not easy. It's been but Embry-Riddle's been side by side with us to try, and they have the contacts to try to get this thing. They've never done this before, where you have two colleges using the same building, so it's thrown for a tizzy. I guess it doesn't seem that difficult of a concept, but We're working it. The call I took this morning was from the provost at Riddle, who's going to try to get a meeting together with the FAA next week, Jerry, and we will get invitations.
Well, I mean, as long as both programs are.
I mean, we're accredited colleges, and I was talking to Dr. Butler last night. I said, it's not like it's Barry and Tom's aviation maintenance shop trying to, you know, use the place.
Yeah.
You know, we got a good chuckle. I said, hey, that'd be a good thing. Barry and Tom's maintenance shop. But anyway, so we're
working. Old bad Tom.
Yeah. We're working it. And then the BS in Radiologic Imaging Sciences was approved. First class will start this summer. And applications are looking pretty good by the way. Nursing expansion, we continued that this past year, bringing New Smyrna, Deland up in spring of 26, New Smyrna Beach was in the fall. So that completed our expansion, and you know, we are now the second largest nursing program in the state of Florida. And then the airframe and power plant facilities, the drawings, I think Alan's going to show you a little later what that looks like, coming along. You know, the goal is to have them all ready by July, so that when funding comes in, we can hit the ground running and start to build that building. Just quickly there, that's the private school, New Smyrna Beach, Edgewater. I did speak to the president in the fall, and they are working on their drawings with the architects, and there's been some coordination with Alan, but I haven't heard anything in the last month or so, but they're working. I think their plan is still to open in the fall of 27. Quanta Honors, you know, you got a sneak peek through of that facility, and we do plan on doing an official ribbon cutting on the 21st at the board meeting. That'll be our board workshop. So we thought it'd be a good opportunity. You know, Kelly, you had mentioned maybe bringing you know, leadership there. So we'll do the ribbon cutting and invite them to come and look through the facility.
Okay.
So we'll be able to do that there. And we just went through the Lemron Center there. That's wrapping up. I think, as we talked about Lomitar, I think that sets us apart, you know, from a lot of our competitors. And I think it was a much needed refresh and update, and I think it'll just serve us now for a good while longer. The Manatee Fountain, that is drawings. I'll show you a little bit of that. We are getting ready to do that. I think Bolmar's got that project as well. So we're going to get that manatee up there on campus, and we're excited about that. UCF Innovation Center, we did settle, I think, on a location. So they are working on some drawings, and Alan will show you a little bit about that. And then, you know, on our priority list, the next building that we have on our priority list that you all approved is a New Smyrna Beach Edgewater campus building, where we would bring you know, some technical programs, some aviation programs, HVAC programs, welding down to the New Smyrna Beach Edgewater campus. There's, you know, that area is growing and growing. There's that new development. Was it Farmington?
Farmington, yeah.
Farmington. So it's the wave is coming. So we want to be, you know, be prepared to accommodate that area.
Farmington Deering Park.
Deering Park.
Yeah, Deering Park. Okay. So this past session that last year, we did get $5 million towards the building, and we did get $700,000 of the $1.3 we were asking for the college-wide access. That is in progress. You may have noticed, you'll start seeing on the buildings now a black box. So we're starting to implement that access control, where you'll be able to lock down and give certain accesses to different locations on campus. So we're going to talk more about campus safety a little later, but it's been a priority of ours for a long time. We continue to enhance And now the state is also doing it, so the state has some legislation coming forward that might give us some more funding and ability to do some things, and Tanika will talk more about that in a little bit. And then for this upcoming year, we have the $12.2 million left to get the airframe power plant facility. My meetings in Tallahassee has gone really well. Embry-Riddle is also, when they've gone up to talk about it, they've been supporting this program. One of our big advocates, Mr. Hussein, he's also been up there talking about that program, so thanks to Maury there. He's a big believer in this. I think he's actually certified in this himself personally. So, but this is just going to be a win-win for the community. To bring in, to get this degree at, $6,000, and to go out and make $60,000 to $70,000 out of the gate, and then $100,000 within a short order is a great thing for the community. Plus, we're going to use it. As my role with Randy on Team Volusia, this is key to attracting the aerospace companies to come to our area here. So it's really been a very collaborative thing. The county's been working well with us, the airport, Embry-Riddle. So it's truly a team effort to try to get this program up and running. And then again, the second is the ask is the building in Smyrna Beach for $19.5 million. We have equipment that would support that building for $929,000. Then we're also, again, asking for more campus safety enhancements of $1.3 million that will help us finish the access control part of what we didn't get funded last year, as well as camera enhancements that we're starting to do cameras that have facial recognition. So if you're someone who's not supposed to be on campus, if it catches you, it will send an alert. So we already have that camera in the student center, and that's one of the ones I have on my screen. So when you see when people walk by, all of a sudden a box appears over their face. So if you were trespassed from campus for some issue and not supposed to be back, and you come on campus, these cameras will pick up on that. So again, pretty good stuff that we're looking to just continue to make a safer campus. And then again, we're just supporting UCF's Discovery and Innovation Hub. No dollars on our end for that. And again, for the future upcoming projects would be the building for airframe power plant, the campus safety initiatives, looking at the New Smyrna Beach campus, bringing HVAC, welding, and aviation programs. And we're still in progress in moving the EMS to the DeLand campus. The renovations of those two buildings should be starting soon. New programs that we're looking forward to. We're looking at the artificial intelligence and data analytics, and Jerry's gonna talk a little bit more about the academic affairs side. We have a new advanced technical certificate in that program, which can be embedded into the BSIT, and there'll be three new courses, 25 credit hours for that certificate. And then AI awareness, a college credit certificate, it's an interdisciplinary program, which will be 9 credits. So we're looking at, obviously AI, you hear about it all the time, so we're trying to stay right up with it to make sure we're offering education in that area. And avionics is also in the works. We look to start that career certificate in fall of 27. It's a 1,200-hour clock hour program, and that will prepare students for employment in avionics installation and repair technicians. So there's another, other than the big mechanics, then there's the avionics, which is the more electrical side of what they do there. And then some things as we look further into the future in cybersecurity, we have some concentrations, but we may consider looking at its own bachelor's degree perhaps at some point. Then we have semiconductor engineering technology. I went to a conference meeting in Orlando about that. There's a big push in the country to have us manufacture more and more of our own semiconductors. As we know, we remember when the pandemic happened and you could buy a truck, but it wouldn't run because semiconductors weren't in them. So it taught us a little bit of a lesson that, you know, to try to control our own destiny with some of this manufacturing. And then there's a clean room operator program and a certified production technology program that we're also looking at. Athletic update, just again a little quick recap. You know, as we talked about, our women's back-to-back national champions. It's not easy to do it once, certainly not easy to do it twice in a row and to do it undefeated. So great group. You know, as I mentioned, the goalkeeper you saw in the hallway is going to Virginia Tech. Another player is going to FSU, who just won a national championship. She legitimately has an opportunity to win 4 national championships in her career if they continue their streak. So good stuff there on the women's front. Our esports continues to do well. They won their 3rd national championship. So they continue to do well, and it's a growing sport. We've hosted a tournament recently, hundreds of students on campus. So it's really become a big thing, and we jump right into the lead spot right out of the gate. The men's team, as we talked about, they had made the national tournament 5 times since we started the program. So they've been very successful, but couldn't get out of pool play. This year, this first time ever, they made it all the way to the national championship game. They lost 1-0. So we're excited about, I think they have now got to a new level where I hope to see them break out of that pool play more consistently. So pretty neat stuff. And you know what's happening too is we're getting kids, like there's a kid that came on campus from Switzerland that got recruited to UNC Charlotte, one of the UNC's Division I program, and something with his credits from where he took some classes in Switzerland did transfer, so he's not eligible. So we built a reputation. We get a phone call, hey, I got this kid, you know, legit 6'4" center back, you know, so we'd like to send him your way, and then, you know, a couple of years, send him back. So, you know, so he was on campus yesterday. So we're getting that kind of recognition across the country. Cross country, they've been very successful from day one. Again, the men, they won their conference. They placed 4th in nationals this year. They earned academic All-American honors as well. They've been very strong. The women, they won their 3rd region championship, and they finished the highest ever. They finished 3rd in nationals this past year, which is pretty good. It's a big field, a lot of colleges in there. So to finish 3rd in the country is so that got them a trophy, that put them on the platform. Men's basketball, you may have heard, we did lose Joey, our head coach, got the head coach at FIU job. So we're happy for him. You know, we have 5 seasons with him. You know, his first season was rough because you inherit what you get and late recruiting. And after that, four years in a row, conference champs, and then 3 appearances in a row to the national tournament. So certainly we've got a lot of really good applications looking to replace his position. I don't know if you caught the Final 4 this year, but Brad Underwood is the head coach at Illinois, and they were in the Final 4, and they went over his history of coaching, and he's a Daytona Beach Community College back then head coach.
Wow.
So we got some good, I got people texting me, hey, did you know Brad? I'm like, yeah, I was there. I used to ride the treadmill next to me, you know? But yeah. So it was some good recognition there. And overall, the academics, you know, the thing that really, I think, sets us apart from some of our competition is, you know, we really invest in their academics. We want them to graduate. You know, you'll see programs where the basketball team will be a whole new team year after year. Sometimes some sometimes different between fall and spring. And same with all the teams, but, you know, we don't recruit those players. We want, you know, we want players that will fit our model and will work hard in the classroom as well as on their court. So they do really well. Women's flag football, year two, they're going to the national again. So they're heading to the national tournament. Softball and men's baseball, they're in the hunt for their first postseason appearance in decades. So we've been able to turn, get, you know, coaching change recently. The women's softball coach is in year three or four. So, you know, it takes a few years to build your team, and they may make postseason this year. And last season, you know, golf won the Southeast District and finished third in nationals. And I think they'll do at least that or better in nationals this year. The team that won the national tournament last year, still pretty good. It's possible. I'm talking to Laura. You know, it's one of those things. If our best plays her best, and their best just plays average, then we could. We might be able to take it, but anyhow. But she's real high on the next class coming in. So, and she has a great course to play on, by the way. All right. So I mentioned this. So I'm going to have, you know, again, there's a lot going on at the state. It's going to be nice to update you all on what's going on at the state level with campus safety. So with that, Tanitha Clemens will take it over. Yeah.
All right, so good morning again. So I'm going to provide an update on our campus safety efforts, some legislation surrounding this area, and how we're positioning the college moving forward to ensure that we can respond appropriately to any critical incident that may come our way. So starting with a strategic investment in campus safety, as Dr. Lavasso mentioned, we received $700,000 in legislative funding to enhance building access control across our campuses. Currently, this is allowing us to tackle 10 buildings across the campuses. So this means improving entry control, emergency response capabilities, and also our real-time security efforts. In addition to the $700,000 in funding, we received the college is contributing actually $100,000 to install additional security cameras to make sure that it's enhanced around the campus. But we're also contributing another $100,000 in camera refresh dollars to make sure that cameras with outdated technology or outdated camera views are being updated as a part of this project as well.
So I remember, I think when Tom referenced this early, the ask had been of the state at $1.3 million, and so that leaves a delta of $600,000. How much does it take to do the entire campus at the end of the day?
Well, you know? I would say I don't have an accurate number on the entire campus. We have about 44 primary buildings that we have to do, but I will say the 10 buildings that we're doing is costing us about $565,000. And the other $130,000 we're putting towards buildings that are already equipped with access control and expanding those efforts. So I would anticipate that even with the additional 1.3, we would still need some additional funding to cover all 44 buildings.
So this will probably be an annual ask for a bit.
You know, I think if we get the 1.3, that, and then, you know, we'll do a little match. We'll come close to getting it, and we might be able just to finish it off ourselves.
Okay.
There is another bucket of money coming our way potentially from the state.
Okay.
And so it may come. We may get two. Like, I almost debated whether we should ask. So, you know, I talked to the budgeting office up there, and I said, no, I know we're asking for this, and she goes. And she said, well, you know that they're putting something forward for the colleges. I said, yeah, it's probably not going to be enough. So, you know, if for some reason we think we may get both, which would be nice. And that should definitely take care of everything.
All right.
So with this particular project, we've adopted phased implementation. So we're hoping that at least these 10 buildings will be done in early June.
Okay.
All right. So the impact is huge, as you can imagine. So essentially what this allows us to do is secure buildings quickly and reduce the number of buildings that we have to go around and lock down manually in the event that we have a critical incident. And so we want to be able to see who is entering the buildings at real time. As Dr. Lovasso mentioned, with the facial recognition technology, we're able to upload a picture of a person and it can track them all around the buildings. And that's good for us, but it's also good in the event of a law enforcement response, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But it also gives us the freedom and the flexibility and just make sure that we're solid and making sure that we're in alignment with the state and national expectations surrounding campus safety. All right, so the broader environment. So over time, there has been a shift and the expectations regarding campus safety and security. And so there's been an increased focus on preparedness and response. So they want to make sure that the colleges are equipped with everything that they need in the event that a critical incident was to take place. We're also seeing the K-12 requirements extended to higher education. I'm going to talk to you all a little bit later about the Guardian program, but that's one of the key things that we're seeing that at the K-12 system now, but is it being extended to higher education? And then the other thing is risk identification and mitigation. So they want us to be able to be aware of incidents before they happen. So that's your threat assessments, making sure that you're following up on those types of things before they escalate into something major. And so our current response, we are taking meaningful steps. I mean, we wouldn't be who we are if we weren't doing that. So the installation of new security cameras, building access control, facial recognition technology, and FUSIS. So FUSIS is not an acronym like we love here in higher education, but it is a software program that allows live video feeds and other data to be compiled into one law enforcement platform. So what this would do, in the event we had a critical incident in the Elgale Lemoran Student Center, as an example, law enforcement would be able to tap into our cameras, see what's going on in the building before they actually respond to it. So that helps them with a better coordinated response. They're not going in blind. They know where the assailant is, and hopefully we can mitigate that threat. So we're really looking forward to that particular technology. And all of these things combined are helping us to enhance our safety infrastructure and the technology surrounding this area. In addition, we are reviewing our policies, procedures, and protocols to make sure that they are solid in the event of a critical incident, because we want to make sure that we are able to respond appropriately if something happens. And then also making sure that our staff are trained to respond to a range of incidents, knowing when to loop in law enforcement. That could be the difference between a super small incident or the big incident. So we're working through that as well. In addition to that, we have contracted with law enforcement through the use of detail officers. So on this campus, we have detail officers Monday through Saturday. And then on the regional campuses, we contract with other law enforcement agencies Monday through Friday, so we can make sure that we have coverage across all of our campuses. Okay, so the key legislation. So one of the things that is coming down from the legislature is the active response and mitigation of on-campus risk. That's the ARMOR Act, or House Bill 757. Now, there was a Senate bill companion for this, Senate Bill 896, that was rolled into this one. But if passed and signed by the governor, it will implement several things. One, a new offense, so a second-degree felony for anyone who is discharging a weapon or a firearm within 1,000 feet of a school. Now, it also enhances the definition surrounding school. Up to this point, higher education institutions were not included in that. So a part of this bill text, it will be. So that will help us a lot. Another thing is records portability. So K-12 records currently, when it comes to threat assessments, behavioral assessments, or psychological evaluations, we don't get that data. So they leave the K-12 system and they may have had a series of issues and problems and disruptions on their campuses, and they come to us and we don't know about them. So part of this is developing a system that would allow us to get that data and screen those students before they come to our campuses so that we can mitigate risk when it comes to that as well.
I was just on a call. We did had a demo of the of a system that they're using in the K-12. So if does it, you know, someone has an issue when they be enrolled, we'd have to get the same platform, and we would be notified that the student, you know, had X issue, and, you know, and obviously we got into discussion because, you know, we are open access, but, you know, and so they're working on things so to support us to say, well, you know, we won't enroll you here because of whatever incident you may have had. So, you know, or, you know, and we do this sometimes when we have an incident on campus where, you know, it's just based on judgment. You're not welcome back on campus, but you can finish your degree online if we have an online option. So we exercise that. You know, we try to give that option. You know, even education always is the key to helping someone get, you know, to a better place. So, you know, whenever we can offer that option and someone does something on campus that causes them to be expelled, that we, from physically being here, that often was an online option. But we went through a workshop, a demo just a couple days ago on that system, where they you can see where they plot things in, what's going on. And sometimes it could just even be like a mental health issue that we get notified of, so that way we can be prepared and provide our services, you know, for the student when they arrive.
But if you don't have the platform, you still are able to receive the information, right? Or
no, right now there's no transfer of information. It just doesn't, you know, it just doesn't get to us. And I don't even know if we would see. We get that's like a separate request. I'm not even sure that the schools would give it to us at this point. I know we get transcripts, academic information.
Yeah.
But then there's a separate file that.
But when the Armor Act, if that passes, yes, then even if you don't have the, yes, platform, you would receive the information?
Yep. Correct.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
So in addition to that, it establishes some new requirements of us. So we would have to develop our own threat assessment plans, risk assessments, training for faculty and staff to ensure that we're able to respond, and these are things that would have to be submitted to the state to make sure that we're in alignment with what it is they're asking of us. But the major component of this is the Guardian program, as I was mentioning earlier. So this would open it up and allow Florida College System institutions to participate in it. And essentially what it is allowing us to either hire or designate personnel to be armed on campus. So that would be completely different, something that we're just not used to outside of our law enforcement detail officers. They would have to complete 144 hours of sheriff's administered training, pass a psychological evaluation, of course, and a drug screening, and be subject to retraining guidelines. And so this would require coordination with the local sheriff's office in order to administer these programs. Any of the weaponry that they use would have to be in coordination with the sheriff's office. So that's where it would come from in order to do that. So we're currently evaluating this because we're trying to see, like, do a risk analysis to see if it makes sense for us to expand our current detail officers or tap into the Guardian program or do some type of combination of both. So we are looking into that to see what would come. Yeah,
this is where funding is going to, you know, come into play. If they give us some funding, you know, then that obviously helps us answer that equation a little bit. Because I joked with Tanika, I said, I'm not going to make her the guardian so that, you know, between her HR job, she can rush to, although she said, I'll do it. So we would, you know, most likely do a combination, because we do have, you know, we started this years ago where we have on each campus a detailed officer that's here. But it's only one person. So, you know, I can envision us having a few guardians with the detailed officer as a model. But, you know, the current pay rate that we currently have for our campus safety officers would not work for hiring someone who's going to carry and be a guardian. So there's a pretty big expense to that program. So we're going to see. Now, if they don't fund it, does that mean we don't do it? No, but it's just going to take more planning on our budget side of things. And unfortunately, this year's, you know, I think going to be a pretty lean year, unfortunately. But so, you know, bottom line is we probably will have some version of it, hopefully in a few years.
Is it, so is this, make sure I heard you say it's not funded yet. So that's the key. But is it passed?
Not yet. It's waiting for the, so for the K-12 system, yes. But for us to be included, where it's on the governor's desk awaiting a signature.
So if, I know that not every college in the system has a police officer training program, has a range, and all the other things that we do. There's, you would have to think there would be some kind of a waiver that we could get to train our own people instead of having to go through. I'm not against the sheriff's office. I'm just simply saying, before the sheriff's office had a program, they came to us. Why if we're certified? We're certified
think,
in that area.
So I think I think I answered. So our program trains the basic, right? And then the training that, so they would be probably gone through our program, but then to do the extra training to be the guardian, we don't do that. That's like a next step training that the sheriff's offices throughout the state do. So they take someone who's gone through our program or even their own program. And then if they're going to be a guardian, then there's that extra training.
So
they would do that extra piece.
Is there a possibility that we would offer that? Could offer that?
I don't know.
I think it would depend on if the legislature is willing to change the bill text. The way they have it structured right now, it is just for the sheriffs to do it. So the funding model, like the sheriffs are able to get reimbursements for working and collaborating with higher education institutions to do this for the K-12 system. The sheriff's office is taking kind of the bulk of the risk because they're training the folks. They're making sure that, you know, they pass the psychological assessments before they dispatch them into the areas. They're providing the weapons and all of that stuff. So
it's kind of like an infrastructure already there, yeah. for that. And then you would just be tacking on. Our training, it doesn't do that next step training that the sheriff's office does.
All right, so looking ahead, of course, we're looking ahead to the $1.3 million legislative request that we submitted. This will allow us to continue expanding access control and surveillance. We are working to increase our coverage across campus to make sure we have no blind spots and that we can respond effectively if something was to come our way. And then we're also continuing with a strategic evaluation of our campus safety efforts to make sure that we're doing all that we can in the event of a critical incident. So with that, you have any questions that I can answer?
I might have shared with you about a year ago, we actually had a case where we got a phone call that someone was going to come to camp, to Building 100, our building, the Weatherwell building, and shoot the beam. So we had to do a lockdown. And so we had, five different entrances. So that took someone manually get over here and lock five doors, where what this technology will do, you get that call, press a button, it's locked immediately. So it cuts that time down by a lot. So we had a real need for the use of this technology just less than a year ago.
Is the communication piece already in place where you're able to send something out to people in the area?
Yeah,
we that's do. Already
we already have that. Yeah, yes. We have the alerts. Yeah, we got. And we got. You know.
Yeah.
That's text.
We got text, email, phone, and then you have even a
outdoor speaker.
We have an outdoor speaker that would say shelter in place. You know, and that kind of thing. We have that as well.
Do you have video cameras at the entrances and in the parking lots and so on, so you know who's coming and going?
Yes, we do. And we are looking to expand those, and particularly with the access control doors, each of those doors will have its own dedicated camera, so you can see who's buzzing in, who's coming out, with actual time stamped and logs to compare that to.
Yeah. But we have a couple spots that we've identified that we want to get a better angle, you know, kind of thing. So we're looking, you know, we do that, and we do that every year. We're always tweaking, enhancing, but yeah, it's just a sign of the times, so just keep enhancing what we're doing.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have board open discussion time, and I will say right at the outset, I will not bring up relocating the cemeteries or bringing the beach back into Daytona Beach State College. So other than that, it's open game. That's the last I'll say about it.
I thought you wanted to rename it Palm Coast.
So, great presentation, and it's interesting times that we're in. I think that we will have some challenges with the legislative session that we've already experienced, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens in funding. It's rough times up there, sharp elbows. And so hopefully the funding comes through and we'll see that progress. But I would really, I'll bring up again the idea of a risk management insurance associate program. I think it's an opportunity. It remains an opportunity. And I think the jobs are certainly available in this area. The state is increasing in its demand as far as where it ranks in the world. It's right at the top as far as insured values. That's not going to change. Mm-hmm. And I think to be in position here to support what's happening with UCF, hand in glove, I think that's a tremendous opportunity. Again, when we talk about associate programs and getting into the risk management insurance arena, you're talking about graduates with an associate's degree that can earn high-paying careers and take care of their families for a long, long time. And they don't need to, they may not go on to get their bachelor's degree, but those jobs are out there, they're available, and I think great opportunities. So I would be happy to be the champion for that kind of program, but I think we need to do it.
So now that you are representing one of the best partners in the community, that was something we've talked about, and so, you know, we are sort of fine with looking to do. And you're speaking from that perspective, and they would support that in addition to what UCF is, and not see it, us trying to undercut that.
Correct. Initiative. Absolutely.
That's what we needed to know. Okay.
Jody?
Just yeah. No. Just note that.
Yeah. Newly noted.
Yeah.
Because that was, you know, we've talked about that, and I know if that was, you know, the UCF, you know, thing that they wanted to have happen, that UCF did it versus us being able to do it. So that's good. Clarity. All right. Anything else? And we can continue on, and as it flows, you know, there may be other topics that, you know, we can jump into.
Any, I know Randy would have probably brought up the idea of the charter.
We do have a presentation on that, and so yeah, Jody will cover that.
Okay.
Portion, and we can talk a little bit about that, because yeah, it's changed a little bit.
Okay.
Last year we talked about doing some research about the options that are out there, you know, and Dr. Howard's really, you know, he's actually the one that advised, like, let's not get into the business of charter schools. And what he really wanted to do was more like a lab school situation that UF has, but there's limitations or obstacles that we really can't do that. So it begs the question on what do we do if anything at this point, but Joey's got a couple slides that talks about the differences between the two types, and then, you know, if we want to move forward, it would have to be the charter school unless a statute changed, and then there's a lot of things we have to do. We just can't start a school in a couple floors that we have. You know, I can't reshuffle the deck and just start the school because there's all kinds of requirements that we found out we need to have in place to do that. So I won't say any more because I'll just take her presentation away.
Okay.
All right. So, you ready?
Ready.
Ready. All right. So next up is Dr. Long.
I'm delighted to be here with y'all today and share some of the exciting things that we have done and some of the things that are coming up. And yes, Dr. Lovato is correct that if he kept talking, he was going to take my entire presentation because he already stole most of my thunder. But I'm going to do the same to Alan because I've got a couple of slides in here that I'm taking from Alan. So, that's right. Hey, listen, you know, copying, I think, is the best form of flattery, right? So, all right. So I wanted to bring back a couple of programs we talked about last year, just to give you an update on where we are with accreditation status and with starting some of these programs. So the Diagnostic Medical Sonography AS degree that we have at the Deltona campus, we've submitted our self-study, and the accrediting body, the Joint Review Committee on Education in Diagnostic Medical Sonography, or the JRC-DMS, they have not had enough volunteers this year. And so our site visit was delayed past the spring into the summer. It's not a big deal. The students are still gonna graduate. They can still get jobs. Our major healthcare providers are still hiring them fresh out as soon as they are done. So we should have our first class, we have our first class graduating in May, and we should have our site visit in early summer. So that's an update there. And the self-study is brilliantly done. Our lead faculty member in that department is just absolutely fantastic and has such a passion for the discipline. So I think we'll have no problems with that particular site visit. Our aerospace technology program, Dr. Lovato had already mentioned that we started that this semester. We're very excited about that particular program as well. There's been some good interest. It closely aligns with our engineering program. And so we have some of the students that, you know, they thought, oh, engineering's not for me. And then we mentioned aerospace and they're like, oh, tell me more. And I had that happen at an open house at one point in the last couple of weeks where there was a mom that was there with her two teenage sons and they were kind of hanging back. And the mom was kind of pushing them up toward the engineering table. And I said, you guys don't want to talk about engineering? And they were kind of like, no. And so I said, how about rockets? You guys interested in rockets? And they're like, yeah. I said, okay. I said, guess what? Aerospace technology is part of the engineering that we have here. It's a separate program. You guys could be into that. And they each took like a step closer to the table, like tell me more. So we're very excited to be able to offer that as well. And then we had, if you recall, we had our Bachelor of Science in Engineering Technology, the Industrial Engineering. They had just had their site visit for their accreditation. And we were waiting on getting confirmation of that, and we did indeed get it as anticipated in the summer of 2025. And we had thought that with that, we would see an increase in the numbers of students enrolling, and sure enough, we did. It's very exciting because we now have 407 students in the BS and the various flavors of engineering technology that we have. We have 64 that are in the electrical, and we now have 19. We only had 4 last spring in the IE concentration. Now we have 19, so that's continuing to grow. We're very excited about that. So 407 is just incredible. It's booming at the ATC for sure.
The only thing I'll mention on this slide is a shout out that medical sonography, you know, that was brand new program, new facility in Deltona, and the last application pool was like 200 applications for 25 slots. So it's doing extremely well.
And there's about 50 openings right now locally for sonographers, so it's very exciting. And then we had talked about some program expansions last time as well, so I wanted to give you a quick update on where we are with that. So again, welding, as we mentioned, we're looking at hopefully landing some welding at the New Smyrna Beach location eventually. But we do, the cohorts in Deltona where we expanded recently are full. So we've got 20 students both in the day and the night program. The night program is predominantly our high school dual enrollment students. And then here at our Daytona Beach campus, we do have 36 students in both the day and the night cohorts. And we are still looking at potentially doing some expansion to the ATC in addition to the New Smyrna Beach location. So welding is really taking off. In healthcare, again, you know, we were expanding nursing, and so we added 60 seats last year. We had 30 seats that we added at New Smyrna Beach last fall, and then we had 30 more that we added at Deland this current semester. We're going to add 30 more again. And so what that does is it actually allows the students that are in the western and the southern portions of our service district to have their training at a consistent location instead of having to move around to different places. So it keeps them, you know, their commuting costs down as well as keeping them in their communities for their training. And at that point, when we have those last 60 seats this year, we will have 810 students in our nursing program. As Dr. Lovasso said, it's the second largest in the state for the Florida college system. So it's very exciting about that. And we're having conversations now. If you've ever been to one of the nursing pennies, it's held at the News Journal Center, and with this many students, we cannot get all of the new nurse graduates on the stage anymore. So we are trying to figure out if we're going to change our format for that, or if we are going to have two services for the penning. So it's very exciting for our graduates. And again, moving on to radiography, our entry-level generalist radiographers continue to be in very high demand. They get snapped up quickly, and they get pushed into the specialties very quickly as well. And so there's perpetually these entry-level vacancies because of that. So we were able this year to add a couple of faculty members and to expand our radiography program, the AS portion of it. And all of these students, we started the new cohort in the spring, all of these students will be eligible for the Bachelor's of Science program in radiologic and imaging technologies. So yeah, very exciting. Lots of opportunities for a really great career trajectory for those graduates. Let's see, moving on. So we had already mentioned that we've had paramedics start last summer at Flagler Palm Coast. And then we brought in an EMT cohort this past spring. We work in conjunction very closely with Flagler Tech as well. They start their night program. It's a part-time program, and it starts every fall, and it serves a high school dual enrollment population. So their completers, as well as our completers, are able to go right into our paramedic program, and so that has been really great for that community as well to serve that need there. I do have, let's see, no, moving on from there. All right. And then the last one I wanted to mention was the Santa Honors program. You all heard at the last workshop how great those students do from coming from that particular program. And right now we have a capacity for 68 students, but with that expanded space that you all toured recently, we are actually going to be able to, we're adding 10 students over the next four cohorts. So we'll have an additional 40 students. So we'll have over 100 students in our honors program. And so that's also really fabulous for those students who do get to go to places like Stetson on full scholarships. So that's exciting. All right, I've got one other little update on things that we've talked about before. I apologize, these pictures are a little tiny, so hopefully you can sort of see them. But so at Deland, as you know, we were closing down operations in building one so we could renovate that to have the paramedic and the first responder programs in building one. The library had been in building one, and so had the writing center. And so we moved and consolidated the writing center, the library, and the academic support center all in one location on the second floor of 6B. We recently did our little ribbon cutting sort of internally with the students being able to come on out and have a little tour. Students are loving it. The tutors are loving it. It's a beautiful new renovated space. We're able to create some additional room actually in the way that it got configured. Thank you, Alan, for thinking about the tables down that one wall that we originally had not planned. And it is made for a great place to set up practical mock practicals for our students taking anatomy and physiology in preparation for the nursing program. So, very exciting. All right. Now, new things. There we go. All right. So, again, our Bachelor of Science in Radiologic and Imaging Sciences. I won't dwell on this too long, but again, it was approved in November by the State Board of Education. And the reason I want to bring that up one more time is because Dr. Lovasso, as he was headed to the State Board of Education meeting, he said, Jody, there's two people that work in the industry that are on the state board. I'm like, yeah, I know. He's like, what, tell me more. I was like, it's gonna be fine, and it was. And these two folks that are on the State Board of Education, Mary Lynn Magar, she's the Vice President and General Manager of Heart Care Imaging, and then Dr. Grazi Pozo-Christie, who's a radiologist in the Miami area with 25 years of experience in radiology and diagnostics. They were both so very complimentary of our proposal, and we're very excited and felt like this was definitely a need across the state, not just here, so.
I was afraid of them asking like a technical question. I said, tell me about the equipment that you're buying for this area.
Yeah. That's right. So I was sitting there with my phone, because I was at a meeting in Orlando, so I was sitting there with my phone waiting for a text, like, and I was watching, you know, watching and ready to go, like whatever I needed to say, to be like, Tom, say this, you know. So.
Just wind me up and
Yeah, that's the best equipment in it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the our research.
It's the C400 model, yes.
It's the C400.
Yeah.
That's right. So, and as Dr. Labasso mentioned earlier, we are hopeful to open our AS program in aviation maintenance management this coming academic year, hopefully in the fall. We are still pending FAA and SAC-COC approval, and I look forward to the meeting with Joe from the FAA next week. So the FAA has acknowledged our application, and it is being reviewed locally by the Orlando office before it's being handed off to the federal office. So our substantive change proposal for SAC-COC about this program has been received, and they are waiting for the FAA approval, so we need that to complete our package for SAC-COC review, and then we will be good to go. We're interviewing faculty candidates right now, and we anticipate hiring the first faculty member in the coming weeks, really. And in the meantime, our curriculum content, I just want to be clear, I didn't write any of this because the only thing I know about airplanes is how to get on one and go somewhere. So this was developed by a subject matter expert, Mike Williams. He is a professor emeritus from Embry-Riddle, and he has provided expert guidance and advice on the curriculum, the equipment, and the proposed facility. As professor emeritus, he's still on the lecture circuit, and so he was in Savannah last week, or earlier this week, I guess, delivering a lecture, and he said, yeah, I'm going to stop by this other airport while I'm up there and see if they've got any planes they're parting out, see if there's anything we can use for this program. So he's all in with helping us get this started. So we do anticipate our new facility at the airport will be open in fall of 27. I know Alan's going to share more about that in his facilities presentation. In brief, it is going to be an almost 40,000 square foot facility capable of handling, as Dr. Labasso said, nearly 400 students on a staggered schedule. So we're going to be offering cohorts both in the day and in the evening. The evening cohorts will also have some Saturday sessions that they will attend so they can get all of their content in. So in advance of the building opening, as we mentioned, we're going to be at Embry-Riddle. We're very excited about that. They've been just very gracious in opening their doors. The department chair, he gave many of the tours. Our subject matter expert, Mike Williams, provided a talk for this prospective students. So they were able to see kind of what it would be like to be in class, but also what it would be like to be an airframe or power plant mechanic. And the interesting thing, and I'll just give a shout out to Eric Takino and his team, that we had, with the number of students that showed up for this, the numbers that were registered were on par with some of our regular traditional college-wide open houses. That's how much interest there was. And so that was pretty exciting going into that. We're like, I'm sorry, there's 80, how many already registered? And we know other people are gonna show up. It was pretty crazy. So the open house ran for an additional hour past when it was supposed to. So Mike provided additional sessions for interested students because it was standing room only. So it was a really great turnout, very exciting. So whether our students begin with us sooner at Embry-Riddle or subsequently into these other terms at the new facility, all of these students completing the program are ready for the workforce or continuing their education through an articulation with Embry-Riddle for a bachelor's degree or beyond. So we're really excited at that opportunity. And then just a quick little bit of stealing some of Alan's thunder, because looking at renditions is much more exciting than looking at curricular content on a slide. This is the entrance elevation and the proposed hangar lab space. So the hangar will be set up where it will not only be able to house planes, but also will have some lab tables in there. So some of the labs will occur in specialized lab spaces, but some of the lab exercises will also occur in the hangar space itself. This hangar space will open out onto the ramp because students do have to learn how to like move a plane out and back in. They have to know how to move it out, turn it around, and bring it back in. So that's a couple of things that they will be able to do in this new space. So like all of our career and technical spaces, We did consult with Mike Williams so on that design of the building so that the space will function as closely as possible to real life for the students as they train. All right, on to new stuff. We're ready for new. Is that too fast? Am I going too fast?
No.
Okay. I don't want to keep us from lunch or anything like that. So. All right, so as Dr. Lobasso said, we are looking at some new programs. One that you approved recently was the Artificial Intelligence and Data Analytics. That will actually start this coming fall. Actually, both of these will start this fall. So this is an ATC, so an Advanced Technical Certificate. It contains courses that would be embedded in the VSIT program. And so students can take those classes and they can actually get this ATC. The nice thing about the ATC is if you already have a bachelor's degree and you want to pivot in the workforce, and you've got the prerequisites to get into these upper division courses, you can jump right into the ATC and you can take that curriculum instead and go off on your own with that to a different career. It's 25 credit hours total. The AI awareness is, oh, let me say this other little thing too. So with the artificial intelligence and the data analytics, one of the things that it does is it works on data analytics methods and software. And so this is going to support the technologies within healthcare, aviation, aerospace, all of those spaces. So the program, as I mentioned, can serve as a powerful re-entry or a pivot tool. So it's pretty exciting as an analyst for operations, projects, data, or reporting, a database technician, or a systems analyst. So lots of options there. And then the AI awareness, this is a college credit certificate. It's an interdisciplinary program, so we have some lower division courses that were already in our programs, business, computer science, and they're the kinds of programs, the kinds of courses that students would take across the, you know, across the, you might be a business major, but you might take a computer programming course. And so they made a few modifications to the content, so we could have the little AI piece that was in there. It's a 9-credit-hour program. We have 4 courses from which students can choose. There's 2 that everybody takes, and then we've got 2 optional courses. We're going to be adding to that option so that more students can take advantage of this. And so this is basically as our AI technologies continue to transform industries such as healthcare, business, education, communications, public policy, legal services, you name it. This is going to be a broad-based AI literacy program for students. So this will, the certificate equips students, regardless of major, with the knowledge and skills necessary to understand, evaluate, and responsibly use AI-enabled systems in academic, professional, and civic contexts. The curriculum introduces students to AI fundamentals, prompt engineering, machine learning concepts, data literacy, AI ethics, systems analysis, and user support. So again, business and computer science majors are our primary target initially, but we are adding additional courses so that other folks can take advantage of this awareness certificate as well. Questions on our new programs? Okay, we'll keep going. There we go. All right, so now new, because new is always great, right? What are we doing next? Because we are always, you know, going to the next thing. What's next on the horizon for us? So again, this avionics systems technician career certificate, you all had approved our ability to move forward with developing this. It is a 1200 clock hour program, and it does prepare students for employment as avionics installation repair technicians. So this is the electrical systems, the radar systems, those types of things that are within planes and rockets. This is what that particular position does. So we anticipate we will have this open as soon as fall of 2027. And it, again, works with electrical and the IT systems and all aspects of aviation and aerospace. Excellent entry point for dual enrollment students, as well as recent high school graduates. The airframe and power plant mechanics program, you have to be 18 to take that particular licensing exam. The avionics system actually allows really nicely for some dual enrollment to jump right into that upon graduation from high school. As somebody who has a birthday in September, I was 17 when I graduated from high school. It matters, you know, like, can I do it or not? So, all right, in addition to the traditional 1200 clock hour program, the other thing that we're doing with avionics is we're breaking it apart. I'm going to talk about workforce Pell opportunities in just a few minutes. And so what we're doing is we're taking this apart into discrete smaller units or modules that students can take that will prepare them to immediately jump out into the workforce, and they can come back and they can do more and they can go back and have a new credential as they step back out. So we're working on that, and I'll tell you a little more about that in just a few minutes. or in a moment. I'll be really fast, I promise. So again, then some emerging programs we have under consideration, as Dr. Labasso mentioned. There's only one other Florida College System school that offers the BAS in cybersecurity. Most of them have sort of what we have, which is like a certificate that's embedded in there, but we can add a little more content and we can actually have the whole program. St. Pete is the other school that has it at the Florida College System level. There are four universities within the state of Florida that have this as well. So it's a growing field. And certainly something that would benefit our local community. So we're looking at possibly adding a little more to our current content in the cybersecurity and cyber forensics area to increase this, to have this full degree. I do want to talk a little about semiconductors. I feel like it's like my little passion project on some weird way, so forgive me. You may know that Florida is fifth in the nation for semiconductor production. The Florida Semiconductor Institute is a statewide hub that is led by the University of Florida. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. David Arnold, but he's a professor at UF, and he has been in charge of this group that has been leading the charge for semiconductor production in the state of Florida. This group coordinates research, workforce development, and industry partnerships that are specifically aimed at expanding Florida's semiconductor ecosystem and the manufacturing capacity. Further interest for our region is due to our proximity to a regional coalition, which is known as the Florida Semiconductor Engine, not to be confused with Florida Semiconductor Institute. Florida Semiconductor Engine is a federally funded regional coalition that's focused on chip packaging and manufacturing in Central Florida. Again, as Dr. Labasso mentioned, he, Dr. Daniels, our AVP for the School of Business, Engineering, and Technology, and I attended the summer meeting last summer to figure out, hey, what can we do? How can we step into this space? It's an emerging opportunity that we're exploring. Embedded within the AS degree is the college credit certificate as a semiconductor clean room operator, because when you're making semiconductors, you do not want dust in that because you do not want it to not function when it gets into a rocket or your cell phone or your car. So clean room technology has really taken off because of this need here to try to produce more of our own semiconductors. So the content includes, but it's not limited to, electrical and digital circuits, as well as installation programming of robotic systems and silicone wafer fabrication, to include photolithography, plasma etching, and advanced packaging. It's very clean manufacturing is what I can say. It's not like what we would think of back in the day for manufacturing. So, and then we are also exploring a 300 clock hour career certificate that prepares completers for entry level positions as a certified production technologist. This one could be Workforce Pell eligible. Again, more on that in just a moment. This certificate prepares students with foundational and advanced skills in modern manufacturing, including safety, quality assurance, measurement, and the effective use of industrial tools and technologies such as CNC machining, CAD-CAM, and programmable logic controls, or PLC. Students develop the ability to interpret blueprints and schematics with this program, to apply production processes, understand mechanical, electrical, and fluid power systems within flexible manufacturing environments. So basically, any manufacturer can hire somebody that is a certified production technologist. The program emphasizes workplace communication, teamwork, and employability skills so that it can support career readiness in the manufacturing space as well as engineering technology fields. This kind of certificate opens the door for hands-on technical roles in advanced manufacturing and industrial settings, especially in regions like ours with aerospace, automotive, and the high-tech production that we have that's happening here. All right. This is very exciting. Be excited. I've saved Workforce Pell programs till now. So there is a new funding opportunity for students that are enrolling in these shorter term programs. Prior to this change in, so it was the FAFSA Simplification Act that led to this. It was implemented through rulemaking by a committee called the AHEAD Committee, which is Accountability in Higher Education and Access Through Demand-Driven Workforce Pell. It's a mouthful. So they created a new Pell Grant funding eligibility category to allow for shorter-term programs to be eligible for Pell Grant funding for students who qualify. So you might recall the Pell Grant is a need-based grant. It benefits our students with the greatest financial need. So previously, any program that was less than 600 clock hours was not eligible for Pell funding. So this really presented a huge barrier for our neediest of students that really needed to get in, get out, and get on with their lives and have a job that was going to make some money and put some food on the table for their families. And so what this has done is this new funding eligibility category has changed the rules a little bit. So as you can see on the slide, now programs between 150 and 599 clock hours are eligible. And if it is between 8 weeks and 14 weeks and 6 days, it has to be less than 15 weeks. So less than a typical semester by a day and more than half of a semester. So students can enroll in these programs and access Pell Grant funding to pay for them now. In addition to meeting the program length requirements to be eligible for access to the Pell funds, the instructional program itself has to be eligible, which means it also has to have a completion point that allows for industry credential or for demonstrated employment. And there are success requirements for us as an institution. So we have to guarantee that we'll have at least 70% completion, and 70% of the completers are gainfully employed within 180 days. So within this, what we're looking at is taking our existing HVAC program, and we're going to cut it up and put it into 300 clock hour units, so students can get funded for that and get out and work. They can come back, they can finish the whole programs. These will all articulate to the whole programs. And again, we're going to take the avionics, same thing. You can take the traditional 1200 clock hour program, or you can take 300-400 clock hour modules, and we will still be able to provide access to Pell Grant funding for that. And then we've already been working on taking our construction and facilities management program, which is a one-year program, and dividing it up into workforce modules that our local employers have asked for. So we've already been on that. And then the other thing we do have already in place is our phlebotomy program. It is currently will fit the eligibility requirements for the workforce Pell.
This is actually a big one for, you know, like I think of construction programs. Sometimes, you know, we make the program long enough so it qualifies for Pell Grants. Well, the students don't invest that much time.
Yeah.
And employers want them quicker. Mm-hmm. So this allows us to make it shorter. And then which a good number of these students are financially needy, they would have to pay out of pocket. So if they're financially needy now, they can get this grant paid for. You know, maybe we teach something just on framing or laying block or phlebotomy, something short. And now if you're, you know, if you don't have the financial means to pay, you're covered. So this is, we've been talking about this for years, how we were funding, you know, everything was like college credit degree oriented, and this is short term. You know, here's 8 weeks, and now you can get hired, and you can have financial aid. It was almost like if you were short term, you were, you know, not eligible for no reason, really, if you think about it. You know?
That's a big deal. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and at the federal level, they're trying to pass a law that basically allows 529 plans to be used for trade and workforce development. So it's just not confined. It gives a tax advantage for parents who have two kids. One's going to go to college. The other has no interest in going to college, but wants to be a let's say a welder. You know, that program is going to, I think it's a brilliant idea. It's like, what are we doing to make sure that we are equipping our workforce and not just for four-year educations and, you know, geography or sociology or whatever. No offense, it's great. We've got plenty of programs that support that. But I think this is a game changer. It's amazing. And the example that the congressman from West Virginia that's really pushing this in D.C., he gave is like, if you have a welder, they get out, how much does it cost for that welder to basically start their own operation? To hang out a shingle and say, I'm a welder, so you got to have the truck. You got to have the equipment. You got to have the torch. You got to have everything. And it's like, it's probably $100,000.
You left out insurance.
Exactly.
Yes. Important. Liability insurance.
Yes. But anyway, the idea is it ain't cheap.
No.
And so what can we do to give a boost to that workforce? I think this is excellent.
Yeah, we were very excited when this was finally passed. So it just opens up so many doors. including continuing education opportunities, because we'll have some short-term programs from our continuing ed side as well, and students would be, again, you want to pivot, you want to do something different, you want to, you know, pick up another skill or training.
And I think along the lines of what you're talking about too, Bob, is, you know, one phase is the technical training, and then another phase may be how to start a business and run a business and things like that, you know, the entrepreneurial piece.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that we think about maybe possibly in the future ways to add on to this, which could be through the foundation, through grants or whatever, and to help our students not just get their certificate or get to the point where they've got their certification, but maybe get them started out in their careers, you know, through some other mechanism. But anyway, I think this is a great, great beginning.
Yeah, we're very excited about the opportunities for our students. All right. Ready for schools?
Yep.
All right, let's talk schools. There we go. All right. So again, there was a lot of discussion about possibly launching a lab school. We created a work group that looked at all, you know, involved all the stakeholders so we could research what this would entail for our institution. We considered all the angles, legal, facilities, curricular, student population. We interviewed counterparts at UF, at Tallahassee State College, at Santa Fe College, at St. Petersburg College, and at Indian River State College. We visited Santa Fe specifically to see their physical plan and also to have an extended conversation with their various departments that were involved from the inception to the execution and opening of their charter school. So I wanted to give just a brief overview of the difference between lab schools and charter schools. And I tried to squeeze it onto one slide, so I apologize. So these are governed by two different statutes. With the lab school, the Florida statute 1002.32, these lab schools have to be affiliated with a college of education at a university. This type of school is for conducting research. The faculty that teach in the lab school are college of education faculty that are members of the university faculty. So this type of school, lab school, operates actually as its own school district. It's funded by FTE, and it is part of the university. So the governing board for the lab school is actually the same as the university's board of trustees. Right now, UF, FAMU, FAU, and FSU are the only universities authorized to have lab schools in the state of Florida currently. So we are not eligible for that option as we're not a university. However,
and a couple of key things on that too, which I would inject to that, is like, this board would be the board of that school. Mm-hmm. And the faculty we hire would be teaching in the school and doing research. So those are key differences between a charter and a lab school.
So as you know, the Florida College System institutions now have the option to sponsor charter schools, but we do have to make a choice if we want to sponsor a charter school or operate one. You cannot do both as the same entity. If we wanted to try to sponsor and operate one, because I know Rodney's probably sitting back there going like, I mean, like, Tallahassee State College figured it out. Yeah, so if you want to sponsor and operate one, you actually have to create a secondary legal entity to operate the school that we would sponsor. When you have a charter school, the charter school is indeed funded by FTE for operation. But the charter school board is separate from the district board of trustees for the Florida College System school that would be sponsoring the charter school.
So, for example, we would, kind of like the housing corp, we'd have to create a separate 501c3, create a board for it, and so there's separation.
So again, if we sponsor or we operate, right? If we sponsor, we can contract out the operation or we can create a separate entity to operate the school. The ROI for sponsorship is basically a pipeline for students. It's not a fiscal resource generator. As a sponsor, you get up to 5% of the charter school revenue. But for that, we have to provide oversight and compliance site visits reporting. And that's pretty resource intensive. If we're the operators, we require all the human resource infrastructure you would find at a middle and high school. This includes, but is not limited to, the administration, the guidance counselor, faculty, and support staff. If we were to emphasize high school dual enrollment and follow the model required by the school board for charter schools, students could actually earn a certificate or an AS by graduation. Dual enrollment with 11th and 12th grades does reduce the need for full-time high school teachers if we were to have a charter school. The difference between 6th through 8th grade compared to 9th through 12th grade is a little bit significant as well, so I'd just like to highlight that. In high schools, the student to teacher ratio is 25-1, and in 4th through 8th grades, it's 22-1. So it's a little bit more, more students in the classroom in high school than is allowed for the middle school. The curriculum's different, the certifications for the teachers for middle grades are different compared to what was required for high school. Operators would obviously be required to provide all the instructional materials, textbooks, laptops, all of that. Security is different from a college. I know that you heard Tanika say that we're having some of that sort of trickle up to us, but not all of these elements are trickling up to the college system. But you do have to have fences and doors that can remain closed and locked at all times. You've got to have a guardian or a school resource officer. So there's some other, you know, some things we want to think about how we would put this together if we were to land it on our campus. There's some USDA guidelines that we follow in terms of food service. So just things that we need to think about. St. Pete, just of note, they actually pay for their students to have a card to go eat in their cafeteria. So there are some
ways. But I think that's not an option for the 6th through 8th kids.
That's correct, not an option for 6th through 8th.
So what's important is, because we've talked about 6th through 12th, you know, do a middle school and a high school type thing. If we dip into that, that's when requirements become even greater in terms of you have to have your own cafeteria. We can't leverage our cafeteria if we have middle school kids. The fencing around the building, you have to have, it has to be secured like you would see a public school. So there's different restrictions. Now, if we just did 9 through 12, then that the 9 through 12, we can share the cafeteria, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and that's a big expense, big deal in terms of doing that. But and we don't get funding up front.
Correct.
So all of this has to get funded by us up front, which is, you know, I'm gonna guess just to build a building and all that, you're probably $80 million to start. So, because you'd have a building. You'd have to have a cafeteria, and if it's 6 through 12, you have to have a gym, right?
Yes,
yeah. That's another thing. So you have to. They can't use our gym. We'd have to build their own gym. So, you know, again, it's anything's doable. But it does, you know, make us take a step back and say, okay, is this really, you know, what we want to continue to move forward to in this charter arena? Location, you know, in our master plan, we have, you know, the idea of, you know, there's about 3 buildings we could take down, but then the question becomes, we're somewhat landlocked, do we want to dedicate that really viable real estate to a 6 through 12 building and a fence and a gym and a cafeteria? Or do we look to find 50 acres. If this is something, you know, we want to do as a community, you know, it's going to take a community effort to go to Tallahassee and say, hey, let's find 50 acres somewhere in Daytona Beach and do it there. So those are some of the things that, you know, in talking to Dr. Howard, he is less enthused about the charter idea versus a lab school idea. We thought we can still have it out there as something down the road, but Even to do it on this campus, a lot of things would have to happen first because the physical plan has got to happen, right? So we've got to get funding to, in our plans, we call this building in front of the entranceway across from the Hussein Center on this side. We would need that building to be built so I can move the programs from those buildings in there and then take those down. That's step one, is get funding and build a building, then move programs, then flatten funding to then put a new building. So you can see there's quite a bit that needs to take place. Doable, but, you know, again, I think the bigger question is, do we want to, especially since it's not a lab school environment where our faculty would be actually teaching, you know, we can't do that model. So it would be a charter school, and we basically would be a 10. Now, there'd be some advantages to dual enrollment for that 11th, 12th grade if it was right here, you know, unless we want to pivot and just do 9-12. That's another option. 9-12 makes it a little less, we don't have to build a gym, we don't have to build a cafeteria. We can do a nice, you know, talked about maybe an aerospace high school concept. So that makes it a little less of a lift on the physical plant requirements. So something to ponder, we can continue to talk about that. Because I think we're at lunchtime, is that right, Lynn?
So let's have Alicia do hers.
Okay.
She's only got three slides, okay. And then they should be finished.
Okay, I just want to make sure we're on track. So any thoughts on that? You know, we can talk about that a little bit.
Questions?
I mean, based on everything I've heard so far, I think going the lab school route makes a lot more sense than the charter school. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has thoughts on that.
If at all.
If at all, yeah.
But we're not eligible.
It's not an option.
Yeah,
that's
an
option for us. Yeah.
You know, it's both are exciting and offer a lot of possibilities. But you know, one thing that I guess on the risk side is you overextend your mission as a state college, mm-hmm. and we are doing so well at what we are doing and concentrating as in our mission,
yeah.
as a state college. And you know, that's the one concern I have is that, yeah, this is a bold venture out here, but it's like we need to be watching our core mission and making sure that we're improving that every single day, every year. So anyway, that's my thoughts.
I agree. I mean, I think there's still a lot left to be done inside that core. So maybe at some point in time that when you've gotten there, maybe you venture off, but I also think maybe there's probably, I'm not sure how the public perception of that would be, of us getting into a charter school, competing with the school system. I'm not to say that we don't need some help around here, right? But that's a whole nother conversation, but I tend to agree with, I don't want to call it stay in our lane, but we're doing really, really good, and more yet to be done before we get off in the weeds a little bit.
And maybe it's taking components that fit into the dual enrollment relationships that we already have existing and identifying small pockets that you integrate into that, you know, maybe a better approach.
And maybe this isn't our baby, but we can be very supportive of anybody else who wants to take this undertaking on. And so if that were to come up, you know, maybe that is really does fall into our mission, is being supportive of an initiative like that. Maybe it's not Daytona State's initiative, but partnering and supporting, facilitating somebody else who would consider doing something.
Correct. Like we this. Could always be the sponsor of an aerospace mm-hmm. high school.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. There could be an entity that they're really that's good at that, and
right.
can you know be involved in a sponsor type thing, and get our community involved. Where you know there's mm-hmm. Advisory boards that are there to. You know, every riddle folks, if it's aerospace and whatever else, mm-hmm. to make it a really good magnet type of school, that you know. So and then finding a location that makes sense.
Right. There's been some conversation about the Deering Park property.
Absolutely.
Right. There's opportunities.
Well, and I think the conversation though was more about, because think about we're actually going to do something like this.
Right.
Right on our new Smyrna Beach Edgewater campus.
Exactly.
The conversation was really, what can we do for Daytona Beach as we try to attract business you know, and, you know, executives and things like that to this location and looking for a school that, you know, prep type school, magnet type school, Daytona Beach. So that was the problem to solve, is the Daytona Beach.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, I think New Smyrna Beach, Edgewater, that pulls off, that's going to be a pretty good school right there.
But that's a sponsorship level, right? That's we're sponsored.
So in that scenario, we're not a sponsor. We're actually just a landlord. It's going to be a private school.
Okay.
That's a private school. Yeah.
I know that there was.
Initially, yeah. But we didn't want to be a sponsor.
Yep.
They approached us. They went to the school district to deny them twice, and then they decided to go private because the statute changed now that the FTE follows the student. So we can put up a private school and get funded that way.
Yeah. Yeah, the complications, I think, too, when you start to look at what they're contemplating in Deering Park, which is ambitious and really to be a connector with the aerospace industry in Brevard County and in Southern Volusia County. It's got some great prospects for Embry-Riddle. It's got great prospects for Daytona State College. But here we have, and it's just kind of illustrative of the potential conflict, we've got what's going on our New Smyrna Beach campus. Are we to be able to support that charter school that's just down the road in Edgewater? It becomes a little bit of maybe you're spreading yourself a little.
I think you know,
and maybe in conflict.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, because we're moving aerospace programs to New Smyrna Beach, so that school will have that aerospace flavor to it. So we're already kind of, I don't know if they're aware of that plan. I mean, I don't know if you tell them that will change their mind per se, but I think we're already got the wheels rolling into doing kind of what they're looking to do already. And maybe a duplicate. So if they got to go get charter, plus they got to go, they're going to go get a charter at the school district.
That's right.
Another hurdle there. But and they may say, well, you got private schools just opened in down New Smyrna Beach, Edgewater campus. So. Okay.
All right. Well, I would say thank you all for letting me share all the wonderful things that we have going on in academics. And I guess we've got Alicia coming up next to give us a quick accreditation update. Is that right?
I'm sorry.
No, okay.
Text message distracting me. I didn't hear a word you said.
Okay, no. It's okay. It's okay. Yes. Come on down, Alicia.
Oh.
Hey, what an introduction.
Oh, man. Okay.
Three slides.
I know. Look, I anticipated this. So that's why I did you all the pleasure of only having Zoom to go through three slides. It's still morning, right? So good morning. I am here to just give some quick highlights about where the college is and transitioning into a new accreditor. And I'm Alicia Alexander, by the way. Let me please get them. Anyway, all right. So I think I'm in the right one. Yay! All right. Okay. So briefly, we are in the process of transitioning into a new accreditor. So Senate Bill 7044 passed in 2022, requiring all the public colleges and universities to change accreditors. They all had a powwow and agreed on the Higher Learning Commission, which I am pleased with that decision because I really do like the way that they operate. All their staff there are Agile certified, and so I want to be as well. It allows them to, they just, anyway, for another discussion, but it was a great choice. So we are in good standing with SAC-COC. We haven't abandoned them. We're still compliant with all of our reporting requirements with them in terms of their annual reporting and, of course, reporting all the wonderful changes we're doing on campus. And so we will continue to do that until we are fully under the membership of HLC. So it's a tricky timeline, which I'll go over briefly, but it works out well. So we've been doing a lot of research, going back and forth, figuring out all the little pieces and making sure that we adhere to the timeline, but also that we don't spread the college too thin, trying to maintain that status with both agencies. So, as of now, we are in step two of a three-step phase with Higher Learning Commission. And so I'll tell you a little bit more about that in the next one. Okay, good. Aww, my colors. Anyway, Shayla, much prettier. Anyway. So I'll start from left to right. We had our application submitted in January, approved in January, so that speaks to, again, how well the organization runs. Typically, they said that it was going to take 30 days, and they did it in like 14.
Wow.
So that quickly moved us into the peer preliminary review stage, which we're in right now. Each stage is meant to be less than a year, because they've made this new process really for Florida. Called the initial accreditation, accelerated application for initial accreditation. And so it's meant to be like an 18-month accelerated process. So anyway, we're at step two of that. We anticipate we'll actually have all the components of that done before January 27, which is what you see here. But the organization has these scheduled review portions in there, so we have padded the time in there to allot for that. Some of those have board meetings that have quarterly and specific dates, so catching those dates is how we end up extending some of the time. But once we're done with step two, which would be late December, early January in terms of hearing back, then we move into step three, a comprehensive evaluation, which is the more in-depth portion. So if you were here with SACS, you'll see when we did the reaffirmation, we had to do this really big report, and then we did these site visits and interviews and all of that. Same thing here. We'll have a report. We'll have an on-site visit. Well, they want to interview faculty, staff, and you all as well. Their process is shorter by 2 days, so we don't have to put on a full-fledged production, but we still want to put on a good show for them. And let them know how well and how good Daytona State is. And so after we're done with the comprehensive eval and on-site visit, which is about September, and that's strategic because September is when campus is alive, students are on campus, but before it gets crazy, midterms and homecoming and all that stuff. So try to be strategic with that. And then after we're done with that, they have two levels of final approval. One is a group call. Institutional Advisory Council. It's a group of peers. They look at our stuff, say, yeah, we love Daytona State, move it on to the HLC board. And that board meeting is the final approval. Based on their schedule, which is quarterly, we would be posed for their February 28 meeting. But the process itself will have concluded probably around November of 2027. So it's moving, it's happening fast. The dollar signs represent the cost associated with all this, because this is not free. This is probably about $40K or so, and that's not including the travel expenses, because the IAC hearing meeting is in person. Dr. Lovato and selected staff do need to attend in Chicago to represent Daytona State, be there for any questions or pats on the back. And then the board meeting is not in person. We don't have to attend that. They will send a small group here on the on-site visit that we do have to host, but they're here 1.5 days. SACS EOC was here for 4 days. So yeah, it's right. We put them up in the hotel, it was a whole thing. Anyway, so that would be the conclusion of that process. So it's a little, 2028 sounds far away, but it's really not, yeah. We're moving along well, so I think we may even beat this a little bit, but I like to plan for the worst and then surprise you all later with great news. Any questions about the timeline? Wonderful. And I think this is my next to last step. Okay, so what does this mean for the board members? Keep doing what you're doing. all the policies, all the procedures, the meetings, the evaluation, this retreat itself, these are all things that the accreditors like to see. They're compliant with both SACS, EOC, and HLC. A lot of their criteria overlap because they're all subject to federal requirements as well. And so a lot of this is an easy transition. We did well. No recommendations in the last one, so we'll just keep doing what we're doing now, and we should be able to come out fine. again, maintaining good standing with SAC COC, continue approving new programs and giving us the money for all this, helping us secure the money for all the things we need. For the HLC on-site visit, again, just having support for any of the logistics while they're here, where they visit, who they talk to, and then also, again, having the funds to be able to help them have a wonderful stay here and go back to where they came from in Northwood. HLC is huge. They're about 19 states. They cover 19 states. The conference we went to in March, over 1,000 people. We're in the Hyatt in downtown Chicago. Great organization, but they're huge. And so it's different, but we're excited, so.
The question, I know, you know, on the board governance, the policy, we went through that process before SACS just a few years ago where we upgrade policies when needed, but we also just went through and reaffirmed policies. Are we gonna need to do any of that, or is it still fresh enough that we're good?
Yes, most of them are fresh enough that we can continue on. There are some changes. I was talking to Dr. Long about our substantive change policy, some of the more, you know, second level policies we do need to kind of freshen up. Okay. But what I like about HLC is that they ask for a snapshot. So with SAC COC, they wanted to see, give me data for the past 3 years and from 4 years ago, you know, some weird combination. But they say, you know, just tell us what happened recently. And so whatever happened recently, you just put it in there. So I'm capturing 25, 26, everything's live right now. And the other thing is with the agile approach that they have, if there is something, we can turn around and say, oh, here's the updated version. Mm-hmm. And they'll mark it off and we'll move on. They're not a gotcha organization. They're really there to assure that the colleges continue to improve and to actually help us get there if it looks like we need it. They have several online series of training, workshop webinars. They do some in-person ones throughout the year. So they're just like a bank of resources.
So there'll be a few policies that will come in front of the board here in the next year.
Yes.
For them to approve, okay, yeah.
Yes.
And I remember we reaffirmed the bond. We either changed, updated, or reaffirmed every policy in preparation for SAC. So even if we made no change, the board looked at it, reaffirmed it, and it gave stability stamp a more current date to show that the policies had been reviewed by, all policies had been reviewed by the board. So, okay.
Definitely. And things like having meetings like the President's Cabinet, where those are the opportunities to look at it, even if it's not stamped, just the fact that we have opportunities to have discussion about does this need to be updated is also sufficient.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And that's it for me.
How long can we be with HLC? Like, is the law like now you can only be with an accreditor for a certain amount of time?
So the way it's written right now is that every college has to attempt going through this process by 2032. But it doesn't go beyond saying, well, once you get into HLC, you have to do something else after that.
If we wanted to, we could just stay with HLC forever.
Correct.
The whole point of the law was really just to get rid of SAC COC.
Well, I'm not going to say it, but.
And do we get any funding, like when they pass this, was there any funding, like, hey, I know you're going to have to pay for two at the same time? No, okay.
Yeah. I call it an unfunded mandate.
Yes. Like health insurance. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but I think then once we're in HLC, are they on a 10-year cycle as well?
They do have a 10-year cycle, but it's a little bit different than SAC COC. So SAC does the 5-year and a 10, they do a 4 and a 10. And okay. Then they do they break it apart. So there's a 3-year multi-campus visit, which is probably why they don't have to stay so long, but they come the 3rd year to visit your campuses. Then the 4th year you do the report, and then you don't have anything until the 10th.
Sounds like you like working with them more.
Yeah, they're just, you ask them a question, they say, huh. They go back, they go to a meeting, come back, they change one of the forms I'm working on, they just updated it, removed 3 sections. They said, you can use the old one that you're working on, or you can use this one, no, I'll use that one. I'll use the one you just shortened. and that was based on a conversation that happened at the conference in March.
Yeah,
so that
more
was just like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
More flexible.
Very flexible.
Yeah, I mean, I think these accrediting agencies visit, you know, I always feel they're healthy things to do, you know, they an opportunity to, you know, kick the tires, make sure everything was going well. And if you have a good team that comes, if they're there to help you, not get you, and that's definitely their motto. And we had zero findings with Saxeo City, so but I think it'll be fine.
Yeah, I do as well.
It's a lot, as you said, the timeline. Yeah, you know,
that's a lot.
It's not something that, you know, once we just got accredited that we jump on a treadmill and start running again, but that's why we go to the gym.
Yeah, it is a workout.
Sort of an ASB.
Yeah, ironically, I will say as I exit, SACCOC, they're probably about 7 years behind, so they're finally starting to make some of those agile decisions that HLC has already been doing. Yeah, but it's too late.
That's
so
right.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thank you.
All righty.
Lunch is served.
Lunch is served.